This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Herman Schwartz joins me live in studio. He is a professor in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. His most recent book is Subprime Nation, which is a must reading if you want to understand the subprime crisis and the housing bubble explosion and the pieces that we, Herman, that we continue to try to pick up and make sense of. It's amazing how it's still, that bubble bursting is still echoing now in different ways that we're just dealing with.
Yeah, it's the gift that keeps on giving for me, but I think it's a lump of coal for everyone else.
Yeah. We have a lot we want to talk about. Let's get to the big news today is the fact that the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives just today, going past Republican objections, passed a permanent extension of the Bush-era middle-class tax cuts for taxpayers making up to $250,000. This is very likely not to go anywhere in the Senate. Republicans in the House and the Senate have said that they want to support tax cuts that go beyond $250,000 for millionaires and billionaires. So help demystify this for us and help us understand where these tax cuts came from and what the debate is all about.
Okay. So the tax cuts came from the recession that happened 10 years ago, which is the bursting of the internet bubble. And the Bush administration said, okay, we're in a recession. The government has a surplus. Clinton administration had created a surplus on the federal budget, was paying down the debt. And then the internet bubble burst, and the Bush administration said, somewhat correctly, okay, the government has a surplus. Let's put some demand back into the economy by cutting people's taxes. But what they did was not entirely in sync with that argument, because what they did was cut taxes in a way that largely delivered tax cuts to people who already had a lot of money. The tax cuts were skewed towards people who had very high incomes two different ways. Number one was rates came down more for upper income people. And number two, rates came down very sharply for capital gains and dividends. And the fact of the matter is the top 10% of the American population owns about 75 or 80% of stocks and bonds. And so a tax cut there delivers money mostly to that top 10%.
Yeah, that's made off of money. It's not money made from getting out and turning a skill or your time into money like most of us do.
That's right. It's not money made from working.
Yeah.
Okay, so the problem with cutting taxes that way was that people who make money off of money and people who have that much money can't spend it as fast as it comes in. And it doesn't do the economy much good if a rich person goes out and buys one BMW sport utility vehicle made in South Carolina at a price of approximately $80,000 as compared to four families going out to buy four Honda Accords made in Ohio or four Ford Fusions made in Michigan, because four times as many people get employment from buying the four cheaper cars as compared to the one expensive car. So what the rich people do is they tend to save their money and put it back into the stock market or the bond market, which drives prices up there but doesn't produce any additional consumption. So the tax cuts originally were designed to get the economy going. They did get the economy going a bit. What really mattered even more was the very sharp fall in interest rates that the Fed did, bringing rates down from about 6% to 1%. And that's what caused the housing boom. So the Bush tax cuts that are being changed today are a legacy of that first that recession from 10 years ago.
Yeah. Which and they're slated to expire on December 31st in just a few days here.
Yeah.
At the end of this year. So the big debate now is the Democrats are saying we would like to extend these quote unquote Bush tax cuts, which I guess will become Obama tax cuts. We would like to extend those for everyone making less than $250,000 a year, but return them to the Clinton-era levels if you make more than $250,000 a year.
Right.
Although I guess we should point out that if I'm a millionaire, I still get a tax cut on my first $250,000.
Yes. Okay, so again, when the Republicans and some Democrats passed this first set of tax cuts, they had the same kind of long-term deficit concerns everybody has today. even though the government had had a surplus, there were still concerns about the deficit reemerging. And so they deliberately sunsetted these tax cuts. The only way to make them work with the rules that the Senate has and the House has for keeping the long-term budget in balance was to put in a sunset clause. And that's the expiration on December 31st that you just mentioned. The problem, of course, is that right now, 10 years after that recession in 0001, we find ourselves in an even worse recession. And so what the Democrats are trying to do is a very delicate balancing act between two different goals. One's short-term, one's long-term. The short-term goal is to put money into people's hands so they spend it, so that the people who are out of work can get back to work, pay taxes, and that will bring the deficit down in the long run. And the long-term goal is bringing that deficit down. And so when you look at the structure of the new bill, the idea behind cutting taxes for those making less than $250,000 as a household is to put money into the hands of people who will spend it now rather than save it, and keeping the taxes, returning tax rates to Clinton-era levels for those making more than $250,000 as a household is to make a long-term a down payment on that long-term problem of reducing the deficit.
Yeah.
And that's the goal here. And you can't get everything at once. You have to, you know, make some compromise. The compromise here is to put money in the hands of people who are much more likely to spend it today, which puts people back to work tomorrow, which closes the deficit gap on the third day.
Yeah. And one of the challenges that we're seeing is, and I might be painting with a broad brush here, which I tend to do, and I'm sorry, but is that we're seeing a lot of Republicans in Washington who absolutely aren't willing to compromise on any of this.
Yes, absolutely. So in the House, 98% of Republicans voted against the extension of tax cuts for the households making less than $250,000. And in the Senate, the Republican Senate leader has said that they will pass absolutely nothing. They will filibuster everything that the Senate does between now and the start of the new Congress, and possibly between now and the 2012 elections. So they're on record as saying they're not going to do anything at all.
They're on the record then. The Republicans are on the record in the Senate saying we will not transact any business of the people unless you keep giving substantial tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires in America.
Yeah. So basically the argument is that people in the top 1% who are making, in order to be in the top 1%, the threshold you have to cross is that you need an income of $1.8 million. $1.8 million is what 300 average U.S. families make in a year. So to cross that threshold, you need 300 families worth of income. These people who cross that threshold, the Republicans say these people who cross that threshold, they need their tax cut too. And the theory is, again, that perhaps they'll buy an extra BMW sport utility vehicle or maybe a yacht, and this might translate into more jobs. But in reality, what's going to happen is most of this money is going to be saved because although people's appetites are endless, when you have this much money coming in, it's hard to spend it all.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz. He's a professor in politics at the University of Virginia. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. Herman Schwartz is live in studio. He's a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. We're talking about the very latest on the politics and the economy. So unemployment benefits or jobless benefits, what are those, number one? And why are those so important in this conversation when we're talking about tax cuts?
Okay. Unemployment benefits are a way to enable people to live a normal life, given the fact that there is periodic, that there's volatility in the economy and that people are periodically laid off from companies. And we want people to be laid off from companies. We want companies to fail when they don't make a good product. We want people to move from bad jobs to good jobs. The question is, what are those people going to do while they're unemployed, right? We want that to happen at the margin. And we also, at the same time, want people to be able to buy houses, buy cars, buy things on credit. So you can't buy things on credit if you are afraid that if you lose your job, you will have zero income. So what unemployment insurance is designed to do is to keep people in their houses, in their cars, able to buy food, able to pay rent.
Participating in the economy.
Participating in the economy while they're looking for another job. And two important things here. One is that unemployment benefits are not particularly generous. They're basically capped at around $25,000. Unemployment insurance varies from state to state, but fundamentally you get roughly 50% of your prior salary up to about $25,000. So we're not talking about lots and lots of money per household. It's a bridge. It's a month or 2 month or 3 months worth of money to get you from one job to the next.
That isn't welfare. It's just they're sort of moving the money through you and back into the economy.
Right. Well, all this money ends up back in the economy no matter what, regardless of what you call it. But what it is it keeps you, the idea is to keep families out of poverty. And then the idea is, to keep people in their cars, in their houses. If someone loses their job and they can't make their car payments and they lose their car, they're not going to be able to get another job because you need a car to get to work. So unemployment insurance is a way of getting people back into work at the same time that it keeps them alive. And most of the time, normal times, unemployment insurance runs out after 6 months. So there's a big incentive to go back to work. It's not a lot of money, and it's time limited. What happens when we have big economic crises like we have now, when there's 9% unemployment, 10% unemployment, when there's five people looking for every one job that's advertised, is that Congress comes out and it extends the unemployment benefits, usually from 6 months to a year. And what we've seen in this crisis, because it's really a big one, is an extension to 99 weeks, almost 2 years in some cases. And so what's at issue right now is whether it should be extended a little bit more. And we're not talking about lots of money here. It's about $50 to $60 billion, which is a lot of money for the average person, but in an economy of $12 to $13 trillion, not a lot of money. And it's very important in helping the economy get out of the recession, because the logic here is very simple. If you lose your job and you don't have unemployment insurance, if your unemployment insurance runs out and you own a house, how do you make those mortgage payments? If you can't make mortgage payments, your house is going to go into foreclosure. If your house goes into foreclosure, housing prices continue to fall. If housing prices continue to fall, the banks are crippled.
Yeah.
And if the banks are crippled, there's no lending. So the economy stays in free fall. So this is a way of putting a floor, not just under individual consumption, but also under housing prices and the economy as a whole.
Yeah. We're talking with Herman Schwartz at the University of Virginia, and Peter is with us in Greene County. Peter, you're on the program. Go right ahead.
I'm interested in the conversation, but I don't know if you're addressing one of the reasons, at least, that the Republicans are talking about keeping the tax cuts for people making over $250,000, is their position is that is a large percentage of small business owners who are the majority of employers in the country. And to raise the taxes on them would possibly stop them from employing people.
Yeah. Peter, thanks for the call.
Okay, yeah, those numbers are put out. Those numbers don't add up in the following way. The vast majority of small businesses make less than $250,000. For those small businesses that are above the $250,000 threshold, the tax increase will not tax their entire income. It is the income over $250,000 that is at issue.
They still retain the tax cut
for
up for their first $250,000.
Yeah. So we're talking about, at most, for the typical business that's over $250,000, a few thousand dollars. I don't think there's an employer in the country who's going to make an employment decision over a few thousand dollars. And moreover, if they're going to fire somebody, then the question is, how are they going to make that business work and get that first $250,000? The small business person in this country, most of them are in businesses that provide services to other people. And for them, the single biggest problem is that other people means the 90 to 95% of the population that's going to get this tax cut and that does not have money right now. So I know somebody, for example, who's, as he puts it, is paying rent on four stores but only getting three stores worth of income. And I won't make the details too clear here because there is some privacy I want to preserve for this person. But the basic problem is he needs four stores of income to pay four stores worth of rent. And what he sells is a discretionary item. And if people at the bottom don't have money to come in and buy the discretionary item, his stores are going to go out of business. So from his point of view, a little bit more in taxes is going to be washed out by a lot more in purchasing. And this is about putting purchasing power back into the hands of the bottom.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of it, right, let's be consistent. If you're worried about the deficit, which is what the Republicans claim they are worried about, then you should be worried about federal revenues. And it's not obvious why people in the top 5% of the population by income should be getting money and a huge amount of money, $700 billion in tax cuts. And for those who are in the top 10th of a percent, one person in 1,000, what this means is about $300,000 per person. It's not obvious why they should be getting that money if the deficit problem really is as bad as people say. If the deficit is bad enough that we have to cut Social Security and cut Social Security, which is the primary source of income for 75% of the elderly population, why is it that those who are making $1 million, $2 million, why do they need a tax cut again? I'm not sure what's obvious. It's not obvious to me why that should be.
Let's go to Wayne in Charlottesville. Wayne, really quick, go right ahead.
Sure, yeah. I was just going to comment, and perhaps your guests can tell me if I'm wrong. It's my take, for example, an electronics retailer here in Charlottesville who makes a fair amount of money. He employs a certain number of salespeople, each of whom has to sell a certain dollar amount to stay employed. It seems to me that if he wants to hire another salesperson, that he needs more demand. He needs more people walking in the store wanting to buy televisions, and that would, in fact, give him the ability to hire someone else if his demand increased, whereas cutting his taxes doesn't bring anybody else in the store to buy his goods. I'll let your guest comment.
Wayne, thank you for the call, and we'll give Herman Schwartz a chance to respond to that when we get back after this break for local news and weather. Let's rejoin our conversation with Herman Schwartz, a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. The phone lines are open for you at 977-1070. Before we go back to the phones, I just want to sort of put a bow on this, because we have a whole lot we want to get to, but I do want to try to put a bow on this idea of tax cuts for the very, very wealthy among us that Republicans are not just advocating for, but they're absolutely committing to shutting down government unless we give these enormous tax cuts to the very, very wealthy in America. And yet at the same time, they are pledging to kill any extension of unemployment benefits. And just I know very little about this, but I know enough to see that, you know, if your goal really is to stimulate the economy, wouldn't it make more sense to put money to extend the jobless benefits, to put money into the hands of people who really need it, who are going to spend it and get the money back out into the economy with car payments and house payments and groceries, versus giving hundreds of thousands to a multimillionaire where that money's just going to go into an account?
Yeah, and this is exactly what Wayne, who was before the break, was getting at, that if there's demand at the bottom, it translates into growth for the top as well. I mean, the basic problem in the economy now is there's not enough demand. You've got 9.5% unemployment by one definition. And if you use the more expansive definition, which includes people who are working short hours but want full-time job, or people who have stopped looking because there are no jobs to find, it's probably closer to 20%. And the more of those people you put back to work, the stronger the economy is, the smaller the deficit is. And for the people who own businesses, the bigger their incomes are, because if people at the bottom don't have money to spend, people who own businesses don't get income.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the extension of jobless benefits and the tax cuts for those who are making under $250,000 really is all about giving purchasing power to the middle class and the working poor.
Yeah, because those people pretty much are living anyway from paycheck to paycheck. The average household, the average family in America, people with children, make about $60,000 a year. The average household, which is all household units, makes around $50,000, $52,000 a year. And most of the households that fall under those averages are living from paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah. They're spending what they make. They're not saving a lot, if any. You know?
Yeah, and so any extra dollar they get, they're going to spend, because they have to, or because it makes some huge material boost in their well-being at that time.
Yeah, I have to say, as a sidebar just here, I have to say, I just think it's absolutely outrageous. in Washington to see the Republicans doing this. If you ever really wondered who they are working for and who they are truly representing, it is that 5%, 2%, 1% of income earners in America. They are not representing the middle class.
Right. Well, this is what you saw in the last election was a huge amount of spending through non-party affiliated groups that were funded by wealthy people and were able, because of the Citizens United decision, to run campaign ads and without disclosure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's problematic.
Let's go back to the phones, 977-1070. Barbara is in Charlottesville. Barbara, you're on with Herman Schwartz. Go right ahead.
Hi, Professor Schwartz. You know, everything that you said is so frighteningly rational. And I wonder, I know that psychology is not your discipline, but I wonder if you have any insight into people, I'm talking about the Republicans, who, I mean, would you put it to contempt for ordinary people? Would you put it to absolute immunity to any feeling? I just don't understand.
Barbara, thank you for the call. 977-1070. How do we make sense of the motivation? Because, they said today, and it'll be in the news tonight, you'll see it, the Republicans said, we're basically going to shut Washington down. We're going to filibuster everything in Congress unless we can get these huge tax cuts for the most wealthy people in America.
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak for the average Republican voter because, as you say, psychology is not my thing. But I can certainly say a little bit about politicians. I think their motivations are clear. They're just as afraid as everybody else is of losing their job. They lose their job by not being able to raise enough money to fund their campaigns. They lose their job by attracting the attention of these non-party affiliated political action committees and groups that Citizens United that the Citizens United Supreme Court decision has empowered.
Yeah.
And so, if you run afoul of Citizens Against Government Waste or something like that, or you run afoul of Grover Norquist's foundation, there's going to be campaign ads against you. You're going to lose your job if you're a politician. And politicians in this sense are no different from everybody else. They're afraid of losing their job. So they're responsive to the people who have the money to affect the outcome of an election.
Yeah. And in the corporate state, we're only seeing more and more of these corporations get more and more of the money. I mean, look at all the money that went to Wall Street. They turned around then and used that money to lobby Congress to prevent any Wall Street reform.
Yes, exactly.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Let's go back to the phones. Steve is in Albemarle County. Steve, thank you for the call, buddy. You go right ahead.
Hey, thanks. You made a comment earlier that I had to take exception with. You asked why these people who are in this top bracket should, and I'm not one of them by a long shot, should be allowed to get all this money like it was being given to them. When it's theirs, my question is, why shouldn't they be allowed to keep it? I realize that people do need unemployment benefits, but just on a philosophical principle standpoint, it's not the government's money. It's the individual's money.
Steve, thank you for the call. And we hear that argument a lot from conservatives, that this isn't the government's money to give to someone. This is money that they earned that the government is taking from them.
Yeah. Okay. So this is an important argument. And here's the way I think about it. Government, in some ways, is just like any other business. It makes a product. And it sells that product. And the price of that product is the tax bill. So when you live in the society that we live in, you're consuming the product that the government puts out. And that product is national defense. That product is regulation of the food system. So you're not eating E. coli, which I can't describe in a more accurate way because I think it's one of the FCC forbidden words. So you're not eating E. coli in your ground beef. So that there are schools. So that financial institutions are regulated so they don't steal your money. These are products the government provides for you. And the question is, and so like any other product, you have to pay for it. Just like you can't walk into the grocery store and walk out with the loaf of bread without paying, you cannot walk around on the streets benefiting from police, benefiting from supervision of the food system, benefiting from public schools, benefiting from all the things the government provides without paying a price for that. And the political arguments are precisely about two things. What is the price we're willing to pay for these products? and how much of that product do we want? That's one question. And the second question is how that price should be distributed. And on the second question—
Like who should pay what?
Who should pay how much, yeah. And on that second question, we might say one way of understanding a fair price is that everybody should pay the same thing since we all benefit equally. But in fact, we don't all benefit equally. The people who have more money benefit much, much more from government services than those who have less money. People who have higher incomes typically live 5 years longer than those who have lower incomes. So they're getting 5 more years of service. People who have high incomes, we know this, get better police protection. People who have high incomes live in better neighborhoods and get better schools. And so it's not surprising that they—
And the money they make on their capital gains is the money they make investing in corporations are often beneficiaries of corporate welfare. That is money out of our pocket that is paid directly to businesses.
Yes. So, you know, the real question would be, is there some kind of gross disproportion there? So I agree, you know, in some sense, people work and they earn money, although the very rich are living off of dividends. This is the Paris Hilton thing. Let's concede that they work and they make money. And then the question is, why should they pay taxes for these? Why should they pay taxes? And the answer is because they're buying a product. And we can say they're perfectly free not to buy the product. If they want to go unpatriate themselves, as it were, and move somewhere else, in some ways I say fine, find somewhere else. Move to
Which
China.
Is what corporate America has done.
Yeah, corporations has
have
done that. Yeah.
taken their businesses elsewhere. Yeah.
So move to China and see how durable your savings are. Or move to Somalia, a more extreme example, your savings disappear in a day.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz at the University of Virginia, and Charles is in Albemarle County. Charles, thanks for your patience. Go right ahead.
Historically speaking, a true or false question, are tax revenues, receipts by the government, higher or lower during low tax or high tax periods?
Taxes as a percentage of GDP or taxes in dollars? If you're asking taxes in dollars, that's not a meaningful measure. I don't actually know what the answer is, but taxes as a percentage of GDP rose under the Clinton administration when tax rates went up. And that was the whole point of raising taxes. Clinton was confronted with the deficit. There's only two ways to close a deficit. You either raise taxes or cut spending, or of course you can combine them. So I put the question back to you. If you want tax rates to stay where they are, which is to say to keep these tax cuts in place, what are you going to cut given that 3/4 of government spending is Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and national defense? That's the hard question.
And what needs to happen, obviously. Yeah. It's so obvious because we never got that quote-unquote peace dividend 20 years ago. What needs to happen are cuts to military spending. It absolutely needs to happen to save the economy of this country. And yet both sides in Washington are like, oh, no, we can't do that.
Yeah, or you
and yet we spend more money on the military than every other country in the world combined.
Yeah, or you raise taxes back to the Clinton-level era. Equally important, and probably actually even more important than anything we're talking about, is you get growth started again. Growth solves lots of problems. Growth solves the deficit problem because it generates more revenues and makes the economy bigger. And growth solves spending problems because when people are put back to work, they don't need unemployment insurance, they don't need food stamps, they don't need Medicaid.
Yeah. And getting the growth started is a short-term way of saying we return the purchasing power and the financial well-being to the middle class, to the vast majority of Americans.
Right.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Jim is in Charlottesville. Jim, thanks for your call. Go right ahead. Jim, you with me?
Hello?
Yeah. Is this Charlie or Jim?
Charlie.
Charlie, I'm sorry, buddy. You go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Good evening. This may be a naive question, but maybe it follows what the previous caller was discussing, but with the Deficit Commission reporting out, I think, tomorrow, is there any political will to, I guess, let these tax cuts expire and let the unemployment extension expire? It seems like it's an either-or question. Like, the Republicans want the tax cuts to be extended, or the Democrats want the unemployment benefits to be expanded. So
Charlie,
it seems to me to attack the deficit, maybe you let both go.
Charlie, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And just for the record, the Democrats are willing to extend the tax cuts, too. They just don't want to extend them to those, at least right now, as of tonight, making more than $250,000 a year.
That's right. So, I mean, we could make a prediction that the tax cut bill passed by the House will be DOA in the Senate. It only takes one senator to filibuster. It's unlikely that the Democrats could find enough Republican votes to override that filibuster. So there is some probability of a train wreck, just as there's a probability of a train wreck over extension of the federal debt ceiling in March. I don't gamble with my money, but if you give me money, I'll gamble with your money, and maybe we can make some prediction. And my prediction is there will be a train wreck over the bill in the Senate. The tax cuts will expire. And that's the point in time at which there'll be motivation to do something, because when those tax cuts expire, not only will the people making, $1.8 million be suddenly faced with a $100,000 plus tax bill, but at the bottom, what seems like small amounts of money, you know, are very painful. So you take a family that's in the $30,000 to $39,000 a year, $30,000 to $40,000 a year range for household income. That's below the median. It's below the average. But that's your, you know, sort of household starting out, two kids, maybe high school or one high school, one college educated family. They're going to get hit with a $700 tax increase. And those families don't have $700,000. For them, it will be a choice between dropping the cell phone plan, maybe buying less in the way of groceries, driving less, maybe skipping a payment on the car.
The kid doesn't play the sport or whatever.
Yeah. The sport. Yeah. And again, that's where the pain starts rippling back into the economy, because that's less money coming into businesses. That's less money at the grocery store, less money at the gas pump, less money at the clothing store.
It would seem to me, and I'm trying to boil this down as much as I can, it would seem to me that one of the greatest lessons we have learned since World War II is that if you really want to grow this economy and make the American economy truly strong, you empower the middle class and you try to reduce the number of working poor. There's always going to be a certain percentage at the bottom in poverty. I don't think you can take that to zero, even with socialism. But we've learned that if you find a way to get money into the hands of the working poor and the middle class, the economy grows by gangbusters, because they spend their money and they buy homes and they buy cars and they start businesses and on and on. And what we've learned, I think, certainly since Reagan at least, is this trickle-down idea. It's a myth. I mean, it'll grow the economy, but a fraction of the percent of what you see when you try to funnel money back to the middle class.
Yeah, the short answer to that is yes.
Let's go to Mimi in Albemarle County. She's with us. Mimi, go right ahead.
Hi. Okay. Corey, how are you?
Good, good.
I'd like to say a few things. First of all, I am certainly not rich, nor am I uber rich, but I would like to say that it's truly unfair, being a lower middle class person, to blame the rich for everything. Personally, they don't always have better schools. People who are rich don't put their kids in public school. They put them in private school, where, by the way, they do get a better education. And they don't use any more of government services. They don't use any government services except maybe the roads. And as far as telling people that they need to, their cell phone contract can't be as good as somebody else's, who said a cell phone is a necessity of life? People need to learn that with sacrifice and saving, you get what you want.
Mimi, thanks for a call. I got to cut you off there, because we got a lot of folks we want to get to, and I want to give Herman a chance to respond before we have to break here at the top of this hour.
Mimi, I'm not saying rich people are evil. I'm saying rich people have huge benefits from living in this society. And as I say, the government provides a product, and we don't expect that people can just take product for free. And the fact is, rich people pay higher taxes because they get bigger benefits from the government. The government fundamentally is set up to protect property. We want it to do that. Rich people have more property. They're getting more benefit.
Let's go to Jim. Jim, you with me?
Yes.
Yeah, go right ahead real quick.
Thanks for having me on. Sounds like a great discussion. I just got on the radio, but I understand this guy teaches political science at UVA. Don't know if he's an economist or not, but it sounds like you all are talking really economic theory mostly. And I would just, I guess I'd just like to see you also ask someone, there's like two economists at UVA that teach more of the Austrian view of things, because, you know, you're kind of saying things like they're a foregone conclusion and they're no-brainers, but they're very smart, intelligent people who strongly disagree with the conclusions you reach, including Milton Friedman and such.
Yeah. Jim, thank you very much. I'm sorry, I got to cut you off because I'm literally running out of time. Herman?
Yeah, Austrian economics. We could have 3 or 4 hours of show on this. So the Austrian economics position is the position that says, let these institutions fail, let everyone go into unemployment. And
there's no such thing as too big to fail.
There's no such thing as too big to fail. And we saw what happened when that was tried in the 1930s. I'm not sure we want to go back to that. And I'm not sure we want to go back to it, not just for the economic reasons, but also for the political reasons. People who don't have jobs and people who are afraid of not having jobs and people who are out of work for 3, 4, 5 years, they start looking for desperate solutions to their problems. And we saw what happened in the 1930s. Desperate people went looking for desperate solutions. They went, they voted for fascist parties. They voted for communist parties. It was not a pretty thing. It was not a pleasant thing. So it might be true that in an absolute sense, the Austrians are right and we should let all these businesses fail and we should not intervene in the economy. But
we tried that and we saw what it looked like.
Yeah, I'm not sure I want to try that again.
Let's go to Tom in Charlottesville. Tom, go right ahead real quick.
Yes, thanks so much for having me on. I had a quick question regarding the $250,000, and I've heard some arguments that state that small business owners may gross much more than that, but because they employ 2 or 3 or 4 people, they certainly don't clear that, so they would be subject to the higher tax and be forced to potentially lay some folks off. Just wanted to get your comments and would love to hear the answer off the air.
Tom, yeah, thanks.
If you're grossing, let's say, $250,000 and you have 3 employees and you pay them 50 each, then your net income is what's going to get taxed. Businesses don't get taxed
on
the gross.
Yeah.
There's some localities that have gross receipts tax. They're a very small percentage. But the federal income tax, that's what's at issue here, is on net income. If the business has a net income over $250,000, it's the net income over the $250,000 that's going to be affected by the increase. And in any case, it's net income. Federal income tax does not tax gross income. If your business makes $25 million and your expenses are $24,999,000, you're not getting taxed on the $25 million. You get taxed on the $1,000 of net income. That's pretty clear, so I don't think there's any worries there.
Yeah, and the wealthy can also afford better accountants to get those write-offs.
To get those numbers right, yeah.
And they'll get right down to the sweet spot that they want to get to. They do every time.
Yeah.
Herman Schwartz is with the Department of Politics, an expert on the politics and the economy. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. It's always an honor to have you in. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Coy. It's a pleasure.
Well, you've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.